You're watching Notepad. I'm your host, Ibrahim Sani. It is Chinese New Year season. And of course, while many of you are enjoying your reunion dinner or is just enjoying the company of family and friends, some of them you haven't met for the past 2 years even. And many of you are still having a safe distance approach and enjoying the family dinner via online opportunities. Yeah. There's a lot of things that for us to explore as well. Because of this, we want to see what kind of ideas that we can share with us around the dinner table or around the family setting when it comes to ushering in the new Chinese New Year. Joining us on the line right now is Dr. Hilmi Hajamaidin, respiratory physician at Pantai Hospital. Dr. Hilmi, thanks again for taking the time to speak with us. I just want to make sure that you are in a safe place, that you are enjoying your, the comforts of your home and safety. Many of us, of course, have been taking the necessary precautions to remain safe. And of course, the thing that I want to highlight is that this is a season of meetings. In fact, because people haven't been meeting each other, I would call this a revenge reunion. It's funny and strange because the moment I say that kind of phrasing, folks know exactly what I mean. And I know that, revenge reunion is a time when people want to really meet their close friends, their close family members, or even distant family members during this period of time. Maybe you could share with us some ideas that you got when it comes to people meeting up. And since it's the season get your booster shots, there are some conversations into people being hesitant about taking the booster shots, or there's some hesitance into mixing the vaccines. Maybe you could share with us some of these ideas first.
First of all, I hope everyone who is celebrating will have a very good Chinese New Year, and hopefully we'll see a good year ahead of us as compared to what we had last year. I would say that gatherings are going to happen irrespective of what we say or do, but it would be very useful to take measures to reduce the risk, especially when we are dealing with the possibility of meeting more elderly relatives. So you don't want to be bringing something for them that may potentially cause their health to deteriorate. So you can do simple things like making sure that, if you're symptomatic, then don't go in the first place, doing RTK tests or the rapid antigen test before attending a gathering or attending a meeting with loved ones. These are little things that can be done to reduce or mitigate the risk. One could also stagger the meetings and, make sure that you're meeting in a place where things are very well ventilated. But there are many things that can be done to reduce the risk. And of course, the thing that can be done in terms of reducing the overall population risk is to ensure that everyone's adequately vaccinated and is given a booster dose as well. There are, as you mentioned, some concerns about mixing doses. So for example, if someone's had Sinovac, does the third or the booster dose need to be Sinovac or Pfizer or AZ? And what we know from lots of studies that have been done is that mixing the vaccines are actually even more protective in some circumstances. So I would urge everyone who has the opportunity to get your booster dose before going out, before meeting people, so that you have that added level of protection. And the other thing I would say is if you're going to be meeting up with more elderly relatives, a lot of my patients who are from a slightly more elderly group, they have lots of fake news being shared in their WhatsApp groups, in their conversations. So it might be worth sitting down and part of the dinner conversation being about how we could address some perceptions or myths and to correct these. So once again, everyone is making the right decision that will ultimately improve and protect their health.
What I find strange is that if we go to covidnow.com and if you look at the statistics of people being vaccinated, particularly adults 18 plus, we're hitting very high numbers. At 99%, that means most parents, if not all parents, are vaccinated. However, they are hesitant from vaccinating their children. Why is this the case?
For a lot of parents, we would be happy to take risk for ourselves, but we would be a little bit more hesitant if there is a perceived risk for our children. So I think it's quite normal parental behavior to be a little bit more conservative when it comes to taking risk, when it comes to their children. And it goes back to really giving adequate data, explaining things over and over again to different groups of parents with regards to how safe the vaccine actually is. The I suppose, benefit of the fact that Malaysia isn't exactly at the forefront of vaccine development is that we get to see how things are overseas. So we get to see how the vaccine rollout has been in the United States. We can see how it's been like in Australia, in the United Kingdom. And there was a report or a study done by the CDC in the US that looked at, I think, 8.5 million cases where there were vaccines given to children. And the rate of severe events was super low. Even things like myocarditis, it's one of the things that people tend to worry about, inflammation of the heart. There were no fatal conditions as a result of the myocarditis, and even the overall rate of it was lower compared to those who actually had COVID. So once again, very reminiscent to the initial conversations we had in the past about COVID in terms of vaccines and adults. And it's kind of taking that next step and reinforcing the messages. But going back to your point, I would say it is actually quite normal for us to be a little bit more hesitant when it comes to taking risks with our children.
Dr. Hilmi, some risks involving kids not taking vaccines are very clear and critical. Being a respiratory physician yourself, maybe you could share with us some respiratory illnesses with children that do not take the vaccine and, you know, God forbid, they contract COVID-19.
Ultimately, the biggest risk, of course, is death. If I'm not mistaken, something like 105 children have passed on in the past 6 months in Malaysia alone. And you can, of course, multiply that across the globe. So that, of course, will be the most significant outcome. But then there are also large numbers of children who have been affected in terms of long-term symptoms. So long COVID, for example, as a syndrome, is something that we're only just beginning to understand as a concept, and we are still grappling with the kind of mechanism as to why it happens and who it does affect. And not just kids, but if we look at adults as well, there's a kind of a spectrum of symptoms, and it affects individuals in very different ways. So for example, it's not just about individuals who have difficulty breathing, but you could get a real sense of fatigue. If we look even at Malaysian data, something like 80% of Malaysians who had COVID were still suffering from fatigue weeks after contracting the disease. And then of course you've got things like breathlessness, things like coughing, and even not forgetting more mental health related issues such as anxiety and depression. Now all that applies to children as well. So you have children who go through all these things, and if you want to put yourself in a child's shoes, you can imagine if you contracted COVID as a young child, alone, isolated, in isolation, and that process of going through that, both physically and mentally, is very, very straining for a young child.
Maybe you can share with us long COVID amongst children. Is this even a real thing? And of course, maybe some outlook into the risks involved following this.
The difficulty we face is that we cannot adequately or accurately predict who is going to get what. So it's easy to say that, you know, let's get people contracted with the virus, you know, let them get natural immunity, which is one of the concepts that are flying around. But what we don't know is who is going to be affected by these long-term problems. So in that sense, there isn't a way to risk stratify or to identify if your child is going to be at risk or not. Once again, it's like getting measles or getting other forms of childhood infectious diseases. Yes, a lot of children may do very well with the virus, but there will be a small number of individuals who will pass the virus on to others who may not have an adequate immune system to mount a proper response, and as a consequence, develop complications. And yes, there will be some who have long-term effects as well. The problem, of course, is because you can't identify who is going to get what, then you kind of need to take a slightly more holistic approach. And this is where vaccines come into play. You want your child to be able to play healthily, to be able to study normally, to be able to go and do things that any child is supposed to do as part of growing up. And that very importantly includes the ability to go out, mingle with others, have that security, that knowledge that actually most of the kids in that playground is that are all actually adequately protected. And of course, allow schools to open, because one of the things that we don't talk about enough is the impact that all the school closure has had on this generation of children who have been impacted not just from a physical standpoint, but from a development standpoint.
The thing about rolling out PIC kids and then rolling out booster shots for adults, and eventually I would presume booster shots for PIC teens as well, you're going to move a heavy machinery of the government towards inoculating the entire population in a short span of time. My question to you now is, do you think that the government has the wherewithal and capacity to ensure that all the respective programs can be conducted in a safe and orderly fashion to a point where they achieve the targets that they have set for themselves, and of course, the target that is needed for the country to be fully inoculated by a particular time?
It is definitely going to be challenging, but it's once again not something that we have not done before. So we have had situations where we had to roll out lots of COVID vaccines. But even for childhood vaccinations, we are a country that has been blessed with the ability to roll out vaccine programs for children, even in more rural areas. And that experience will be very handy when we're doing this. The challenge is going to be, of course, coordinating things in a very organized fashion. You mentioned in double time. Now, how fast is fast? That's really up for debate. And of course, last but not least, there's the issue of supply as well. So at the very beginning of our vaccine rollout program, one of the bottlenecks was the availability of vaccines. That seems to be less of an issue today. And I think the challenge at this point in time is not going to be about the actual rollout mechanism, but really getting parents to understand and appreciate that this is something necessary, and therefore, as a consequence, enroll their kids onto the program.
All right. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll speak with Dr. Hilmi Hajimaidin of Pantai Hospital. Thanks for staying on with us. It is Chinese New Year period. Kongsi Fa Chai, Sin Ning Kuai Le to all those that are celebrating. We want to do a little bit more of our conversation with Dr. Hilmi Hajimaidin, the respiratory physician at Pantai Hospital. Dr. Hilmi, let's talk a little bit more about Pantai. There's a lot of things that you guys are doing, not just in assisting your patients and your customers, but to the community as well. Maybe you can speak a little bit more to that effect.
We have multiple programs that we have been involved in, chief of which is actually being a vaccine center ourselves. So from the very beginning, we've been one of the few places that have been open to the idea of serving the public. And this is something that I think we're very proud of, something that we have had lots of experience in, and something that we continue to, or rather we hope to continue to provide as a service in the long term. Now, at the same time, we have, of course, been looking after COVID patients as well. And at some point last year, there was an agreement with the government whereby we were accepting non-COVID cases in order to help offload the capacity issues that were, unfortunately, at that point in time, plaguing a lot of the public sector hospitals. So there are many ways in which private hospitals can help ease off the capacity issues that COVID has put on our system. And moving forward, that is going to be, I think, one of our major roles. There are lots of non-COVID cases that are facing delays in diagnostics, in terms of treatment, in terms of management. And I think there has to be some way in which the private sector will be able to help offload these cases from the public sector in order to ensure that patients are getting the best care.
And of course, in ensuring that you deliver all these targets, Pantai Hospital do not work in a silo. You do work with a lot of bodies, and you work in tandem with all of them, including NGOs, NGIs, statutory bodies. How does Pantai navigate working with all these actors in delivering healthcare services to the community?
It's a combination. I would say, one, it's a huge learning process because, of course, all of us have our own strengths. And you tend to come into, or you tend to face a particular problem with your own particular mindset or worldview. And when you engage lots of NGOs or NGIs out there, you start to see things from very different perspectives, and you start to see other issues at play that are very emblematic of the problem that maybe the system as a whole face. And one, it's, once again, you learn a lot, but also it's a very humbling process because, once again, you may be dealing with a situation where perhaps there are limitations in terms of resources, in terms of funding, in terms of what's available. And you need to then adjust the manner in which you would normally deal with a particular situation or in particular cases or patients. So I would say overall, it's always very, very good to actually get different parties from different perspectives to work together, because you then start to address a problem in a slightly more holistic fashion rather than just doing things on your own.
There are some long-standing issues, right, when it comes to respiratory illnesses, like asthma, for instance. There would be some lifestyle change, modulation. Where do you stand on all these long-term issues?
It can be frustrating at times, but then again, so is most of medicine. You're always faced with situations where you have to reinforce a particular message. And the way to deal with it is actually to look at the success stories as well, because overall, when you are pushing a particular health message, you can see success stories, you can see where things work. And that's where you kind of, you know, hold on to as something that makes you want to continue with a particular fight or a particular cause. So in respiratory, as you pointed out, smoking is one of the major issues. We also have lots of issues when it comes to air pollution. And if we look at the way that we are facing or perhaps not dealing with climate change, there's going to be more and more effect on our health in general, but also respiratory very specifically. How do you tackle this? Not on your own. Once again, it goes down to dealing with the system, making sure they have adequate support or adequate involvement by various stakeholders. And this goes from branches or agencies and ministries of the government, to the NGOs, to professionals, and of course to patients themselves, because ultimately what we're trying to do is we're trying to improve the lives of the rakyat. And that can only happen when you empower the rakyat with adequate information, with adequate space and platforms for them to voice out their concerns. And that's why, to me, I feel that yes, it's challenging, but you're never doing these things by yourselves. You always have good teams with you. You always have people who have the same mindset as you. And that on its own is very rewarding because you see the results, perhaps not today, but 5-10 years down the line.
How should we frame our thinking when it comes to COVID? New variants are going to be popped up. We've seen how Omicron and Delta have actually quite shaken the globe right now. And of course, I want to tie this back into the impact of respiratory risks involved when it comes to managing COVID as an endemic. Dr. Hilmi.
To me, one of the key things we have to remind ourselves is that we are facing a new normal. A lot of frustration comes from the fact that many people are looking for an end and they're looking for something that is going to resemble what was normal 2-3 years ago. To me, I suspect in the near future, at least, we will still be faced with situations where we have to wear masks, where we have to be mindful of being socially distanced in particular areas. The numbers will rise and fall depending on what variants around, how transmittable a particular variant may be. So these are things that are going to affect our day-to-day decisions. So I think that expectation that things are not going to go back to normal is very important, but it doesn't mean we can't go about doing things in a different fashion. We can still socialize, we can still go out. In fact, we must do these things in order to, in a way, continue with society and ensure that our country grows in the way that we want it to. Having said that, we don't know for sure what's going to happen with new variants in the future. So we must always be alert. We must take what precautions that are necessary. And it's all about risk mitigation. You can't get rid of it 100%, but you can lower the risk. You can lower the impact that it has on you. And this is where your public health measures come into play, where vaccinations happen, where vaccinating not just adults, but children are just as important, because what you're doing is you're lowering the overall numbers, the overall reservoirs that are there in society. And as a consequence, you're lowering the possibility of new variants showing up. So everything is done in tandem. Everything is done with one goal in mind, which is to go back to some form of normality. But we have to bear in mind, it may not be normal as it was in, say, 2018.
Businesses are opening up. We need the economy to open up. But there are some issues when it comes to opening up safely. What would be your message to business owners, corporate leaders right now? Restarting economy is key. SOPs are in place, but, you know, SOPs are only as good as the enforcement that comes along with it. What would be some of your message towards these corporate leaders and business owners right now?
I would like to see more flexibility and I think more understanding from corporate leaders. There is some tendency to perhaps not do things because it wasn't specifically or explicitly stated by government. So, for example, working from home. I've met leaders or corporate leaders who would say that, you know, government hasn't said anything about working from home, so why should we implement such a policy? But to me, it's not just about waiting for the government to do or say something. It's about taking some form of responsibility as an individual or as a corporate leader or as an entity, as a company, to actually take proactive steps that are going to protect your staff and provide them with an environment where they'll be able to thrive and feel safe. And to me, most people want to be safe. It's not about wanting to skip the office and not attend or go to the office or attend meetings. It's actually being in a more secure environment. And there are many, many studies to show that when you feel that you're in a safe, secure environment, your productivity is going to go up. So rather than, I think, waiting for things to happen, I think it would make far more sense to be proactive. Improve your ventilation, get people to come in and out at different times of the week. If there is a particular rise in case, then be proactive about perhaps being more lenient when it comes to working from home. These are things that I think change all the time. There isn't something that is meant to be black and white that is applicable 365 days of the week. That flexibility, I think, is very important, and we must think beyond what is given as a instruction by the state.
All right. Thank you very much. That was Dr. Hilmi Hajjah Mahidin, respiratory physician at Pantai Hospital. If you've missed any part of this show, just head on to astroawani.com. Look for Notepad over there. You can also look for Pantai or Dr. Hilmi himself on all our sites. Until then, thanks very much for watching. Once more, Happy Chinese New Year. Kong Si Fa Chai. May this year usher in lots and lots of prosperity and happiness and health for everyone involved. Again, from me, Kong Si Fa Chai.